And we're live. How are you, sir?
How are you?
Good to see you again.
I'm thrilled to be here.
Thanks for doing this, man.
Thanks for having me.
I should tell people before we get started, I did not know when I asked you to come back on that you were heavily involved in this whole vaccine debate. What I wanted to have you on to talk about is tropical diseases, because I remember when we did that sci-fi show, you explained to me that some ungodly percentage of people that live in tropical climates are infected by parasites.
That's right. Well, my day job is developing vaccines for tropical diseases. We develop the vaccines no one else will make because they're for the world's poorest people. So we call them tropical diseases, but they really are diseases of poverty. The vaccine issue, the advocacy issue around vaccines and autism is kind of a new thing that I got drawn into just because I'm a parent of an adult daughter with autism and I make vaccines, so it was a natural that I'd get drawn into it.
Yeah, so when I said that you were going to come on, then I got inundated by people that are, you know, the vaccine thing is such a polarizing issue.
Yeah, it's awful.
And so many people seem to think they absolutely know what causes what, especially when it comes to something like autism, which is it's a huge issue in this country. It's a huge issue around the world, and it didn't used to seem to be. The question is, was that because it was undiagnosed? Was that because it just it's more prevalent today? Right. What do you think? What is your take on
this?
Well,
I don't think we really know. One thing's for sure, we're diagnosing people with autism who we diagnosed with as something else in the past. You know, whether it was, you know, really horrible diagnosis. We'd use pejorative terms like mental retardation.
What's the matter, Jamie?
2:40, sorry. My bad. Just telling you the clock was off.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
Should we start again?
No. It's okay. He was just telling me that our clock is screwed up because of the daylight savings time.
Oh, right.
Sorry. Totally unrelated to what you were saying.
The whole country's clock is screwed up because of daylight savings.
Yeah.
Right.
So we don't know.
Well, you know, one thing's clear, the number of diagnoses is going up, but part of that is because what we used to call pejorative things like mental retardation now get thrown into the autism category. The other thing now—
They do. Absolutely. Well,
you know, now we call it as part of the autism spectrum. We also, because autism often has a lot of associated intellectual disabilities, not always, but sometimes. The other is that—
Can I pause there for a second? Is that based on aptitude tests? Like, how do they decide?
What's autism?
Yes,
they have a list of diagnostic categories.
But it's not based. It's not like you could test someone if they test positive for a disease.
That's right. Well, although it, you know, one of the interesting side pieces to this is, you know, there's a group of people out there who self-identify themselves as the autistics. And they get very resentful or hurt when they're called a disease or a disorder, because they say, "Well, we're not an epidemic; we're a person." And it's part of this whole neurodiversity movement, which is quite interesting.
Neurodiversity movement,
right? They say they're neurodiverse; that they, you know, maybe think differently from others and they respond differently than others, but they're not quote abnormal. And I think they have a good argument.
Hmm. I heard a crazy argument once with someone that was—
So the point is that it's, you know, the impairment, like Rachel, my daughter, it's not so much her autism that thwarts her, you know, ability to have partners or to have a meaningful career. It's the fact that she has profound, in her case, profound intellectual disability that goes along with it.
I forget what I was going to say. So when they say that— people have there's a spectrum, right? And some people who are autistic have incredible abilities.
That's right.
They have incredible mathematical abilities, musical abilities, language abilities. And then some people do not, and some people have legitimate issues.
Yeah, with Rachel's case, my daughter, it's she has a pretty good verbal IQ, 80, 90, but she has a very low performance IQ in 40. She can't do simple math. She can't count money. Fortunately, Goodwill Industries came to her rescue and our rescue, and now she works there 2 hours a day sorting clothes, and that's been really meaningful for her to get a paycheck. And,
oh, that's great.
Even if it's minimum
wage,
yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Just to do something and feel—
right.
Yeah,
and feel part of the mix.
Yeah.
That's huge.
That's huge for everyone, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But so there's no it's not like you could test positive for syphilis or you can test positive for the flu.
Right. Although now, you know, as I say, you know, so that's why I don't like using those terms, because it puts people on the autism spectrum as though they have a disease or right. a disorder, which I don't like to do.
But if it is a disorder, no?
Well, you know, now we know there are 99 genes that are linked to autism.
But why is it a bad thing to say that you have a disorder if it's just a disorder? You know, well, people have disorders. It's a fact.
But, well, you know, a lot of the individuals in that that self-identify themselves as the autistics don't like to think of themselves as a disorder. They like to think of themselves as different. It's different, but not necessarily as a disorder.
Right, but that doesn't help us when we're trying to discuss it, does it?
Yeah, it gets very it's hard to talk about.
Well, it also they're trying to stop you from talking about it in a certain fashion, which is actually accurate, right? When they have an issue, there is an issue. To say there's no issue is kind of ridiculous. It's, I mean, there's a reason why so many people are so concerned about autism and vaccines and just autism in general, right. whether it's an environmental pollution
right.
factor.
Right, but what they like to do is they like to make the distinction between autism, that neurodiversity thing, and actually having intellectual disabilities that go along with it.
Okay.
And maybe it's a bit of semantics also, but they feel strongly.
This episode is brought to you by Manscaped. Guys, you're responsible for taking care of you, and that means spending some time cleaning yourself up. But I know that can be a challenge, especially when you're not sure what products or razors to use. So to help you get started, I want to recommend Manscaped. They can help you take care of all your grooming needs, even when it comes to your more sensitive areas. Or as our friends at Manscaped like to call them, the boys. Their trimmers, the Lawnmower 3.0 Plus, 4.0 Pro, and 5.0 Ultra are all equipped with skin-safe technology to help reduce the risk of grooming accidents. They're also waterproof and come with an LED spotlight so you can actually see what you're shaving. And I know that summer's coming, which means vacations and traveling for a lot of you. Well, Manscaped has you covered. Their trimmers come with a convenient travel case that you can easily pack and bring along. For the best you and your boys have ever looked, trust Manscaped. Get 20% off plus free shipping with the code Rogan at manscaped.com. That's 20% off plus free shipping with the code Rogan at manscaped.com. Tap the banner to learn more. Skin-safe technology does not guarantee cut protection. This episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. If you're looking for something to do this summer, you might want to check out some of the upcoming fights. Even better, if you can catch them up close in person. It's quite an experience. But if you want to get the best seats, you have to act fast. And that's true for a lot of things in life, especially when it comes to hiring for your business. You need to hire the most talented people you can before the competition scoops them up. And to do that, you need ZipRecruiter. And luckily, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Rogan. Got your eye on a rock star candidate? ZipRecruiter's invite to apply feature lets you cut the line. Once you review ZipRecruiter's list of the most qualified candidates for your job, you can easily invite your top choices to apply to encourage them to apply sooner. So, amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/Rogan to try it for free right now. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/Rogan. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Right. Now, if we don't know what causes autism.
Well, we do.
We do.
Well, we're getting there very closely. So we've now – there was a very important paper produced by written by a group at the Broad Institute, Harvard, MIT, which is one of the premier genetics, genomics organizations in the country. And they've now identified 99 genes. It's a huge team of scientists, not only at the Broad, including scientists at Baylor College of Medicine, 99 genes involved in autism, all involved in early fetal development, early brain development in the first and second trimester of pregnancy. So now we're starting to really get our arms around what autism is. And that's one of the things I talk about in the book. I mean, we have learned so much in the last couple of years about autism, how it begins early fetal development, well before kids ever see vaccines. And that's one of the reasons I say vaccines did not cause Rachel's autism. Vaccines don't cause autism because autism is already underway in early brain development.
Is it possible that some people have this tendency towards autism and it's exacerbated by vaccines?
I don't think so. I think what happens is the sequence of events happens during pregnancy, but the full clinical expression of autism often doesn't happen until 18 or 19 months of age. Like Rachel, for instance, wasn't actually diagnosed until 19 months of age. And there's some fabulous studies now showing that clinical expression of autism actually coincides with a big increase in the volume of the brain. You can actually show on serial magnetic resonance imaging, serial MRI, how the brain volume starts to increase. And that's very important because parents will often remember, oh, my kid got vaccinated around 18 months of age or 15 months of age, and want to link the two. But now you can go back to 6 months of age, and this is studies done at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, showing so that you can do an MRI at 6 months of age, and they can predict now, with 90% accuracy, which of the kids will go on to develop autism. And then you could take it.
What are they seeing?
What
are they seeing?
They can see we can go into detail in the paper, but they can see certain things on signatures on MRI that tell them that this kid is going to go on to develop autism.
Okay, so in fact, there is a way to test positive for autism then with this serial MRI.
That's what they think, right.
That's what
and,
they think.
And now we have the 99 genes, so we can even take it back further by doing what's called whole exome sequencing, sequencing all the DNA, all the expressed DNA of an individual. And in Rachel's case, we did that, and we actually found a mutation in a gene controlling neuronal connections, which makes a lot of sense if you think about what autism is.
Yeah, of course. So there is a way to show whether children will be more likely to develop autism, and there is a way to look at their brain through fMRI at a very early age,
and also do genetic sequencing.
So it's not simply a matter of how they perform on cognitive tests.
That's right. That's right. We're getting much better at getting our arms around the diagnosis.
Why do you think there's so many people that have these anecdotal stories of their child getting vaccinated, especially large doses of vaccines when they hit them with like 10 in a row, and then all of a sudden, or measles, mumps, and rubella is the one that gets repeated over and over again. That's the one that made my child have autism. I've heard that so many times, and I've heard it from friends that have children that have autism. They had a child, their child got the measles, mumps, and rubella shot, and then immediately there was a very distinct change in the child's behavior.
Well, no question, when you get the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, many times kids cry and things like that. And then autism will then begin sometime between the first and second year of life. So it's logical to want to connect the two. But now we know it's not even plausible, because we know that if you go back to that MRI at 6 months of age or go back prenatally, we can even determine which kids are going to go on to develop autism.
So complementing it,
are massive epidemiologic studies done on over 1 million kids. That, in fact, a new paper was just released this week showing that kids who get the MMR vaccine are no more likely to get autism than kids who don't get the MMR vaccine. And the converse is also true. Kids on the autism spectrum are no more of likely to have gotten the MMR vaccine than kids not on the autism spectrum.
Okay.
So it's the combination of that. Those big studies of over 1 million kids, together with knowing what autism is, that completely rules out the possibility.
Right. So these genes, and the issue with these genes, and then the ability to scan the brain with the serial MRI, so you can tell which children have the propensity. Is it possible that children have all these issues and then do not get autism, or do 100% of those children with those issues get autism?
That's a good question. I don't know. I'm a vaccine scientist, so I'm,
You're not a biologist.
I'm a biologist, but I'm a vaccine scientist who's really tried to do a deep dive in autism doing research on the book.
Versus human development.
Right.
Okay, so what you're saying, though, is that if a child does not have these mutations and does not have these issues that are present during serial MRI, that they will not go on to develop autism. Is that true?
As far as we can tell.
As far as we can tell. Yeah. So children without those issues who get vaccinated have no problems, which most children have no problems, right?
Yeah, I mean, we've learned a lot about the risk of vaccines, and the numbers are extraordinary. I mean, the risk of a severe adverse event happening after getting a vaccine is roughly on the order of 1 in a million, between 1 in a million and 1 in 10 million. And I found an internet report once that the likelihood of getting struck by lightning is 1 in 700,000. So it's, the likelihood of having a severe event after a vaccine is odds are better of getting struck by lightning than.
And when you say severe event, what do you mean by severe event, though?
There's actually a table that's put out by the National Vaccine Compensation Act that includes shoulder injury. That's one, encephalitis.
Shoulder injury.
Yeah, that's actually on the
From list. The actual injection
yeah,
point?
Yeah, injecting it in the wrong place.
Oh, so it goes into the joint or something
yeah,
like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that common?
No.
No. So there have been issues where children have adverse effects and reactions to vaccines. What do you attribute those to?
But one in a million. I think, in some cases
biological variability?
I think in some cases inadvertently, if it's a live virus vaccine like the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, and you have an underlying immune deficiency that wasn't picked up before, then that virus can replicate better. But very rare things like that.
Right. So as far as you know, children who are healthy who get a vaccine, it's not biologically possible for them to develop these traits, these mutations in the genes, and these issues that you see present.
As best we can tell right now, that seems to be the case, right?
As best you can tell right now it's a great thing to say. But for people that are like, on the outside, like, what does that mean? I'm not a doctor. I'm not smart enough to understand what Dr. Hotez is saying here. What is he saying?
Well,
as we can tell. How much can we tell?
So here's what we can tell.
Okay.
We know studies in over 1 million children that there's no link between vaccines and autism. That's number one. And so let me parse
how
this.
Do they
let
do
me
that?
Let me parse this out in two bits. So there's the studies on over 1 million children showing that vaccines do not cause autism. That's part one. The second
this
part,
is the epidemiology
and then I'll do a deeper dive on each of them. The second part shows not only is there massive evidence that there's no link between vaccines and autism, there's no plausibility because we know so much about autism and how it begins in pregnancy.
Okay.
So let's go back to the first part. The first part is studies on over 1 million children. One of the things that the anti-vaccine lobby does is they play this game of it's not really a game, but what they do is play this kind of thing of vaccine whack-a-mole, because at first they alleged it was the MMR vaccine, and that came out of the study that was published in The Lancet in 1998. Then another group came along and said, no, we didn't mean the MMR vaccine. We meant the thimerosal preservative that used to be in vaccine. And the scientific community not only debunked the MMR link, they debunked the thimerosal link. Then the anti-vaccine lobby came along and said, no, we didn't mean that. We're spacing vaccines too close together. Then they changed it around again, saying now it's the alum or aluminum in vaccines. And then each time the scientific community responds with massive epidemiologic studies showing there's absolutely none of those things are true.
And do you think that it's just – when you look at – say if there's 1 in a million that has an issue with this and there's
– And it's not autism, by the way.
So whatever those issues are, that they hear these stories and these stories do accumulate because there's 300 plus million people in this country, and over 10, 20 years of 1 in a million, you develop a significant history of cases where children did have issues with vaccines. So these people hear about these stories and people are terrified. Obviously, I have children. You become very overprotective of your children. You worry a lot.
Right.
And then you also don't know, like, why do they get so many shots all in a row like that? Why does a baby get 10 shots in a day? That seems crazy.
Well, they don't get 10 shots in a day. Most of the vaccines are now combined. So, for instance, in one vaccine, we can vaccinate against diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, polio, Haemophilus influenza type B, which is a terrible cause of meningitis, and in some cases now even hepatitis. So one shot is protecting.
Soup of all these.
Well,
things?
It's combined, and there's right. all sorts of studies showing that it's safe to combine them, and it's fantastic. Now you can vaccinate with one shot against six diseases.
So
and these are life threatening diseases.
Right. So the only concern is the child's immune system when they're bombarded with this one. So a lot of times it causes them to be tired or they get sick or they don't feel
But the
very
point
good.
Is the immune system is not bombarded. I think that's another kind of a misnomer that or a misunderstanding that's put out by the anti-vaccine lobby. Remember, the child's gut, the intestines, and the respiratory tree is this or organs of antigen presentation. A baby, on average, is exposed to hundreds of new antigens every day. So the idea that you're going to, quote, overwhelm the immune system with a vaccine against six diseases just doesn't make any sense either. Mm. Again, this is all phony baloney stuff put out by the anti-vaccine lobby. Let's be clear. The anti-vaccine lobby owns the internet right now. What does that mean? What that means is they've put out now, by some estimates, 500 anti-vaccine websites so that every time you put the word vaccine into a search engine, whether it's Yahoo or Google, you're going to get anti-vaccine misinformation. That's number one. Second, we know now it's amplified on social media like Facebook, other forms of social media. So third, look at the Amazon site. I mean, it's incredible. So my book, this book, the good news is it's the highest rated pro-vaccine book on Amazon. The bad news is overall it's ranked about 20 because there's 19 other phony baloney anti-vaccine books ahead of it. So the Amazon is the biggest purveyor now of anti-vaccine books. And wait, it gets even worse. Then you also have now they've become politicized. They have political action committees in multiple states lobbying state legislators about plying them with false information about what vaccines do. So and the problem is we don't have a robust system of pro-vaccine advocacy to counter it. So we don't really hear as much as we need to from the federal government, from the CDC, from the Surgeon General. So unfortunately, in this country, the defense of vaccines falls to a handful of academics like myself. And, you know, I'm an academic. I wrote a book. What chance do I stand against this major media empire that
Why do you think that exists? Why do you think there is this major media empire that's against vaccines?
That's a great question. What's the motivation, yes. Number one? And number two, where's the money coming from?
Right.
Right, there's real money behind this. There's millions of dollars behind this to put out phony documentaries and phony books.
What's a good phony documentary to point to?
Well, I'm a little reluctant to say it because they're so litigious.
Okay.
I don't have the means to defend a lawsuit and things like that. But
so
they're out there.
These documentaries.
That's why I usually don't name specific names. Or
I understand. Yeah. These documentaries, what do you think their motivation is? Do you think they earnestly believe that vaccines do cause harm or vaccines do cause autism?
I don't know. I mean, is there some kind of other agenda that they have? I mean, we do know in some cases that some elements of the anti-vaccine lobby are promoting phony autism therapies, right? They're doing terrible things like this thing called MMS, which are bleach enemas.
What?
Yeah, giving bleach enemas to kids.
To children?
To children.
Bleach. Wait, why bleach?
Because they're cleansing the immune system.
Oh,
they're
Jesus
cleansing
Christ.
Them of toxins. No, it's really awful stuff.
Wow.
And they're doing chelation therapy, which is very dangerous.
What is that?
That's where they claim, you know, kids are overdosed with toxic metal, so they give a chemical that actually can chelate the metal. But it can chelate your calcium and then put you into a fatal arrhythmia as well. They're also
– Who's doing this chelation therapy? Like
you,
what?
You can Google it.
Okay.
It's – or whatever.
But are these doctors? Like
so in some cases, there are doctors, unfortunately, or other health professionals.
And what is – I mean, I'm sure you've studied this.
Wait,
what is the
evidence? Wait,
though?
It gets worse.
Okay,
there's no
ahead.
Evidence. And then they're doing hyperbaric therapy, which is really bad. So in some –
Wait a minute. Hyperbaric therapy is bad?
Well, it doesn't do anything for autism, that's for
sure. Okay, but it's good for recovering from injuries and
– Yeah, under certain selected – but who knows what it's doing to a young kid, right? I mean, so you shouldn't be doing that. Then that's one – so how much of this is being driven by financial motivation peddling these phony autism therapies. Mm-hmm. I can't say. My sense is that's not the big piece of this.
Yeah.
There's also some reports now of Russian bots and trolls that are amplifying this and sowing political instability in the country. But again, you add that all up, the phony autism therapies, the Russian bots and troll, to my mind, that really doesn't get our arms around the big driver of this thing. So I think we really need some good investigative journalists to look into this.
Well, do you think that there's some sort of a concerted effort, or do you think that it's just a bunch of people that really believe that vaccines do cause autism? They don't truly understand the science, and they haven't talked to someone like you, and maybe mm-hmm. they have this idea that's cemented in their mind, and they're not willing to look at it objectively and look at the full spectrum of possibilities and look at the science behind what you guys are saying, because in their head they've been saying vaccines cause autism. They've been saying it for so long that once someone gets that and they're connected to that,
mm-hmm.
it's very difficult for them to shift gears. People have a really hard time not being married to an idea.
Yeah, no, I agree that. And, you know, when I talk and I spend a lot of time going around the country giving what are called grand rounds lectures to hospitals and medical schools, pediatric grand rounds. So I've had the chance to talk to a lot of pediatricians and nurses and nurse practitioners and more than a few parents. My impression is most of the parents who are called to be so-called vaccine hesitant, as is the word of the day, are not really deeply dug in. I mean, you can have a conversation with them and explain to them, like we're talking now in a very, you know, non-technical way, you know, the evidence showing vaccines don't cause autism and the lack of plausibility given that it begins in pregnancy, and they'll vaccinate their kids. There is another percentage, and I don't know what the percentage is, whether it's 10-15%, that are deeply dug in and are wholly invested in this conspiracy theory that the government is in cahoots with the pharmaceutical companies. Yes. And blah, 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 blah.
Yes.
And then if you try to talk them out of it, they just think you're part of the conspiracy. So it's sort of a no-win approach there. But most parents you can have a good conversation with.
Most parents, yeah. It's not necessarily even most parents, right? I mean, what you're dealing with is these people that maybe they're into a bunch of different alternate therapies, a bunch of different kinds of cleansing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a lot of that nonsense that you find online. Where, I mean, look, there's legitimate.
But I guess my point. Sorry,
that's okay. Please go ahead.
No, but I guess my point is, parents don't get the chance mm-hmm. because they're so inundated with phony anti-vaccine information.
That, if they do a Google search,
whatever, you know, whatever search they do.
So, what do you think should be done? Should there be a pro-vaccine documentary that makes sense?
Thanks for that question. I think there's three things that need to be done. I think, first of all, some of this anti-vaccine media empire needs to be dismantled.
Dismantled.
And that.
But who's to say whether they're wrong or right? Like, shouldn't? I mean, it seems like there should be some sort of a debate, right? Like, if there's someone who's saying that there's some evidence of vaccines cause debate, you're saying there's no evidence of vaccines cause debate. That vaccines cause autism, and you're saying there's no evidence that vaccines cause autism. There should be a debate where there's some sort of a monitored conversation where you can have you versus someone else and break this down.
Yeah, but that's a two-edged sword too, because you know then it gives some false legitimacy to the anti-vaccine side. It's like debating does smoking cause cancer.
Yeah, but isn't there already a problem? I mean, it seems like if there's this many, if you do a Google search and you're just overwhelmed with anti-vaccine, it seems like the fight has already been lost if that's the case.
That's right.
So giving them legitimacy, it's not necessarily giving them legitimacy. It's giving them, you rather, a forum to dismiss their legitimacy.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, part of what has to be done is, I mean, And this gets into all sorts of First Amendment issues, and I'm not a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the idea that Amazon now is putting out all of these phony books and phony documentaries.
They're just a distributor, right? I mean,
yeah.
They don't have to go over every book that they sell with a fine-tooth comb.
Well, but maybe they should. I mean, not fine-tooth comb, but maybe there should be some screening. Maybe Amazon, maybe Facebook should all be hiring chief scientific officers to – you know, putting some stops on the dissemination of information because it's harming children.
Right. I understand.
I mean, this is – the reason I get passionate about it The reason I actually wrote the book is kind of interesting. It actually happened before all of these big measles outbreaks that we've been having.
Yeah.
I noticed that in Texas, there was where my laboratory is at Texas Children's Hospital and Baylor College of Medicine. We noticed that there was a steep increase in the number of kids whose parents were opting them out of getting vaccinated, to the point where in Texas we have almost 60,000 kids not getting their vaccines in the state of Texas. And those are the ones we know about. We don't know anything about the 325,000 homeschooled kids. So we probably have over 100,000 kids not getting vaccinated, all because of this misinformation campaign. Mm. And I was really troubled by the fact that there was no response to it. And that was drove me to write the book. So the point is now Texas is very vulnerable to measles outbreaks. And I say measles more than the others because that's the most highly contagious disease.
What's the danger of a child getting measles? So is there any benefit to a child getting measles in terms of their immune system?
No, there's no benefit. And that's one of the phony books they put out.
Yes.
It's called Melanie's Marvelous Measles. I mean, it's awful. So
what do they say in that book?
They say build your immune system.
It does not.
It does not. So let's go back a little bit. Smallpox was eradicated in the late 1970s through vaccination. Once smallpox was eradicated, measles was arguably the single leading killer of children globally. 2.6 million children died every year of measles because it causes measles pneumonia, measles encephalitis. Talk about permanent neurologic injury. That's a bad actor, measles, and then deafness and all. And then through global vaccination campaigns, we brought it down by the year 2000 to about 500,000 kids dying. And then the Gates Foundation put up $750 million to create the Gavi Alliance, the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunization. We've brought it down now to 100,000. But now measles is coming back. Europe's a disaster right now. We've got 80,000 measles cases in 2018 in Europe, and now it's coming back to the U.S. And so my worry is this: the anti-vaccine media empire it started out as a fringe group, but now it's really affecting public health, allowing a deadly disease like measles to come back.
Do you think if there's some sort of definitive evidence that shows to the general public, like you could show it to them, like this is what causes autism, we've narrowed it down to these genes, and it has nothing to do with vaccines. If you give these vaccines to people without these genes, there is no way they're going to get autism. They get autism specifically because of these variations in their genes.
You just summarized the book.
Right. Yeah. But I mean,
we need more than a book, right?
Right. Yeah. It does disturb me when I hear about all these kids getting measles, and not just measles, but means in some places polio has made a resurgence.
Yep. Well, polio, you know, we're down to about three countries that still have transmission of wild-type polio. It's Nigeria, Pakistan, Afghanistan. So hopefully we're getting our arms around polio. But measles has now come back, roaring back with a vengeance.
But haven't people contracted polio outside of those areas? I mean, those are the areas where it's common.
Every now and then some cases pop up.
We had
some – you know, wherever – and this can get onto a whole other topic. Wherever there's collapse in health systems infrastructure, such as from war, political instability – these diseases can come back.
They can come back, and the people that are vulnerable, the children that are not immunized.
That's right.
And when you're immunized, you're not vulnerable.
That's right.
Yeah. This is it's a really confusing thing for people because on the outside, people always want to think that Big Pharma – I've said some terrible things about Big Pharma, and the reason being is painkillers. Because painkillers and antidepressants and there's SSRIs, which are overprescribed, and the painkiller one kills me because I know people directly that have been addicted to these goddamn things, and the doctors are passing them out like candy.
Yeah.
So people look at Big Pharma as being, oh, these are the monsters that push this. They're also the people that give you things that save people's lives.
Yeah,
there's a lot going on there.
Yeah, I'm no big defender of the big pharmaceutical companies. I mean, one of the things that the insults that anti-vaxxers hurl at me is they say I'm a shill for industry. They say I'm secretly taking money from Merck and GlaxoSmithKline. It's all crap. I don't take a penny from them, and it's not even.
How do
realistic.
You get paid? Just from the university?
I get paid by the university, and some of that some of my salary is offset by grants from nonprofit foundations.
And this is because
like
of
the National
tropical
Institutes
diseases.
Of Health, right?
Yes.
And then they say I'm secretly making millions of dollars for our vaccines for hookworm and schistosomiasis and Chagas.
What are
disease.
You doing with all that money?
Because my wife says, if only that were the case, right? These are diseases of the poorest of the poor. I'll never make a penny on these diseases. So, in fact, you know, one of the frustrations I have with the big pharmaceutical companies is we've made a lot of progress with our vaccines. We've gone all the way from discovery through early phase process development and manufacturing and IND filing with the FDA, investigational new drug applications, but we're getting kind of stuck at phase one, phase two clinical trials because we don't have the big pharma money to take us all the way to licensure. So I've had a lot of meetings with the big pharmaceutical companies to see if they can partner with us, and so far that hasn't happened.
So has there ever been any discussion or any interest in creating some sort of a compelling documentary that's pro-vaccination that can counter all these things? Because there's quite a few health-related documentaries that I know are horseshit because I've talked to actual real scientists and clinical researchers that say, like, all these things they're saying are wrong, and this is why they're wrong, and this you could show this that they're wrong. Mm-hmm. And then when someone says, hey, I saw this documentary, it says that all you should eat is toast, you could say, listen, man, you got to go here and watch this, and it'll show you why that's nonsense.
Right.
Is there anything like that right now, is there any discussion?
Not right now. There are some discussions, but we're a long way off from that. And the problem is the anti-vaccine documentaries are being widely distributed, widely sold. And
those people that are talking about it, here's the other problem. Whenever I talk to someone about – I've been doing this a lot lately – where I talk to someone about something they're passionate about, I go, what books have you read on it? And it's like, well, I saw this documentary.
Well, there are books.
Yeah.
In fact, there's 19,
books are bullshit,
and 19 ahead of mine. Right,
right, but books that are written by actual researchers, people that have spent decades in labs understanding what's going on, you don't get a lot of that from the people that are anti anything.
Right. Well, that's why I wrote the new book.
It's a very confusing thing for parents because you're scared. You know, you have this little tiny baby that you love more than anything in this world, and then the doctors say, hey, we've got this round of vaccines coming, and you're just terrified that you're going to do something to your child. It's going to turn your child into someone who's compromised.
Yeah, and the point is the problem is these diseases are back now, and so the urgency to vaccinate is now more than ever. I mean, remember, right now, look what's going on in Vancouver, Washington right now where the measles outbreak is underway. The ones who are at greatest risk are infants under the age of 12 months, not yet old enough to get their vaccine. So that if you're a parent right now living in Vancouver, Washington, you're terrified. You're terrified about taking your baby out to Walmart or the public library.
Because they can't get that vaccine.
Because they're not old enough to get the vaccine.
Right.
So
now the disease is coming back because the older kids are catching it.
Yeah, and the anti-vaccine lobby uses terms like personal liberties and medical freedom. Well, where are the personal liberties of this parent now who's terrified to take her in?
When you say
his or her infant,
anti-vaccine lobby, now I know that Robert Kennedy Jr. is
He's a big one.
Yeah. And he seems like a very intelligent guy. How could he not be aware of the science behind this, and what is he getting wrong?
What he's getting wrong is just about everything. You know, he's formed an organization called Children's Health Defense, he had a press conference about it, I think it was September, October of last year. It is probably one of the best organized anti-vaccine groups out there. Now, he's doing other things other than vaccines. He's doing a lot of things about environmental health and things like that. I don't know any part of that business. I've only followed what he does with vaccines, but it's all nonsense.
Why is he doing this about vaccines?
I don't know. What's his motive? I mean, you have to ask him, what's his motivation?
Would he be a guy that you would want to have a debate with or have a discussion with?
But again, I mean, I'm uncomfortable with the idea of a debate because it's like debating, I don't know, it's like debating a Holocaust denier, whether the Holocaust exists. I mean, not that this rises to the
same level. I understand what you're
saying,
but if I want to bring this up. If you're complaining there's 19 books ahead of yours that are anti-vaccine books, you've already lost the battle. Like, it's time to regroup, and maybe regrouping would be confronting someone with actual scientific information. I mean, you are a real doctor. Uh-huh. You're a guy who actually studies this, and you're a man who understands the science. You're a legitimate academic. You could actually put a dent in this with a real conversation. This episode is brought to you by Simply Safe. With summer coming up, I bet a lot of you have plans to travel, which is great. You should get out and experience the world. But I also know how stressful traveling can be. That's why I want to recommend Simply Safe. It provides award-winning security and peace of mind so you can have one less thing to worry about when you're away from your home this summer. I think Simply Safe is a great option for home security because it protects your whole home, inside and out. It has a variety of cameras and sensors to detect the worst of the worst, including fires, floods, break-ins, and more. Simply Safe has your back, and I especially like how there's no contracts and a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you can try it out confidently and really see if Simply Safe is a good fit for you and your place. Everyone deserves to have peace of mind when they're away from home, and Simply Safe can help give you that. So try it out today. Right now, get 20% off any new Simply Safe system with Fast Protect monitoring at simplysafe.com/Rogan. That's simplysafe.com/Rogan. There's no safe like Simply Safe. This episode is brought to you by Hostage Tape. First of all, what a great name. This is a product that I use, and I started using long before it was an ad. Your sleep game is about to get a whole lot better, kids, because I want to introduce you to Hostage Tape. Put simply, it is tape for your mouth. But you're probably wondering why you should even need that. Well, if you're a mouth breather, if you snore a lot, or if you suffer from sleep apnea, this could make a big difference. This mouth tape can reduce or eliminate snoring and apnea, and at the same time, it'll help filter the air going to your lungs, increase your oxygen uptake, and improve circulation, which will make you feel more energized. It has tons of other benefits, too, like it helps with bad breath, dry mouth, and of course, better sleep. For you and your partner, don't let bad sleep hold you hostage. Shut your fucking mouth with Hostage Tape. Buy it today and get a special buy two, get one free offer. That's a 90-day supply. Just visit HostageTape.com/Rogan. That's HostageTape.com/Rogan.
Yeah, potentially.
Potentially. Yeah. I mean, what would he be able to say? Like, what is his take on it?
Well, remember, he's an attorney, and he's very clever, right? And,
right.
You know, presumably knows how to do arguments in court, and what am I? I'm a scientist.
So. Right, but do you think that he wants to deceive people? Or do you think that maybe he's just incorrect in his accumulation of data?
Yeah, I can't say what his motivation is, but His information is highly misleading.
Mm. Now, what else is, you say, the lobby? Is this an organized thing?
Good question. We need somebody who really wants to do a deep dive in this and kind of dissect out the pieces to understand. But it's impressive what you've got out there in terms of the hundreds of websites and the amplification on social media and everything else. Are there just one or two or three groups behind it, or is it a random collection of organizations?
Right.
That needs to be looked at.
That does need to be. Now, what do you think is causing autism? And in your personal estimation, do you think that it is that there's a rise in the factors that are causing autism, or do you think that it's a rise in the understanding of these variables that contribute to it that you could diagnose people with and that before they were previously undiagnosed?
So I think most of it is that we're just diagnosing it more, and we're including individuals in the autism category that we didn't before. And by the way, the numbers are about to go up even more because we're getting better at diagnosing girls and women with autism, which is also quite interesting. We used to say it was 10 to 1 boys to girls, and now we know there are a lot more girls and women on the autism spectrum. It's just that they're usually more verbal and they can camouflage it better. But they have very high rates of comorbidities like obsessive-compulsive disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. A lot of the teenage girls with eating disorders now they're finding could actually be on the autism spectrum. So the numbers are about to go up again. I mean, that's just an example. I mean, I guess what you're really trying to get at is it beyond that? Is there a bona fide increase beyond the number of diagnoses? And that one I'm still not sure about.
Yeah, I read an article about early onset gender dysphoria being connected to young girls with autism.
Right,
There's a disproportionate number of girls with gender dysphoria who turn out to be also autistic.
Right, I've heard that as well. Yeah. That's actually – so it's really fascinating to think about. Now,
unfortunate and fascinating at the same time, right?
There's a nice paper by a very good environmental scientist named Phil Landrigan, who used to be at Mount Sinai now. I think he's at Boston College now. And he publishes about 5 or 6 chemicals in the environment, which if you're exposed to for long periods of time during early pregnancy, your child will be born with some features that resemble autism.
Do you know what those chemicals are?
So I have to remember. I talk about them in the book. One of them is Depakote, valproic acid, which is a psychiatric medicine used as a mood stabilizer or an antidepressant. So prolonged use of Depakote during pregnancy has been linked to something that resembles autism.
Is this a common medication?
It's a common medication, but now that we know this information, we don't use it anymore. And so one of the things that I've been saying to, you know, people like Bobby Kennedy and everything else, if you really think there's some environmental link to autism, we've got a list of at least 6 chemicals during early exposure and pregnancy that are probably causing mutations and things like that, that are leading to autism. Why isn't anybody looking into that?
Mm.
It's just crazy. I mean, so all the focus
on
goes into vaccines and it kind of sucks all the oxygen out of the room so that, you know, really understanding the search for autism gets delayed or in some cases doesn't get pursued at all. Or the other thing that happens in many state legislatures and things like that, the focus is so much about vaccines that we don't talk about what autism parents really need. I mean, what do I need for Rachel? We need, you know, employment counseling and help. We need mental health counseling. What do we do after we're gone? Rachel right now is living with us. I turned 60. My wife is, you know, 58. What happens to us 10, 15, 20 years from now? There's no roadmap.
Right.
So all of that gets shunted aside because of these phony baloney anti-vaccine arguments. And that's why I get angry. That's when I start to realize these guys, in addition to affecting public health, are actually hurting autism families as well.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, and I can completely understand why this would upset you, especially as a scientist. Now, when you're talking about these various chemicals that you think do contribute to or possibly cause autism, maybe we should really concentrate on that and publish something about this. Is this something that – is there an article that people can go to that says something about this?
There is. I talk about it in the book.
In the book.
And I could – if I opened up the book, I could provide it for you.
Is there anything that people can read online about this without going to your book?
Probably. You know, one of the problems that we face in this country is that we – put a lot of scientific articles behind paywalls, which is a real source of frustration for me.
And why do they do that?
Well, one of the things that I've done now is I'm one of the I founded an open access journal called the Public Library of Science Neglected Tropical Diseases, so that anybody with a computer, you know, an internet connection, and a printer can download the articles free of charge. And we need more of that.
That's great. But right now, if someone wants to find out these chemicals, they have to buy your book or buy some sort of access to scientific papers?
Yeah, I'm not sure with that particular paper whether it's behind a paywall or not. I'll have to look.
Besides measles, what other diseases are more prevalent now because of people not vaccinating their kids?
There's 3 diseases that I worry about the most, actually 4. Well, whooping cough is another one, so that's one. But the other one I worried about is the flu vaccine. Kids aren't getting their flu vaccine. Last year in the 2018 flu epidemic, 150 unvaccinated kids died of influenza despite the recommendation to vaccinate against flu.
Can you enlighten me on this? Because what I've been told is that sometimes they get the flu vaccine wrong. So you can get vaccinated, but it doesn't protect you for the strain of flu that everybody's getting.
Well, so that's, again, something that was an idea that was heavily pushed by the anti-vaccine lobby. Here's the story. You're right. Last year, there was not a perfect match between the virus and the vaccine, the killed virus and the vaccine, and the wild-type flu strain that was out there. But it was good enough to prevent you from dying, and it was good enough to would likely prevent you from being hospitalized.
So it would have an effect even if you did get the
that's
flu?
That's right, because there was enough cross-protection so that it would mitigate the symptoms.
That's confusing to people because if they have the flu, they say, oh, well, then it didn't work.
That's right, but it did because it prevented you from getting sick and dying. And again, that was a message that never really got out in 2018.
Okay, but let's talk about someone like me mm-hmm. who's a healthy person. I've had the flu before, but I don't usually get a flu shot.
That's crazy. You should. Especially now as you're getting older.
Why is that?
Because flu is probably the single leading infectious disease killer of adults in the United States.
But every time I've had it, it's really been like just a couple of days out. I rest. I drink a lot of fluids.
You got lucky, my friend.
So, is that what it is? Is it luck or is it health?
Well, taking care
of yourself.
Well, sure.
Maintaining your immune system.
I mean, if you look at the 80,000 adults who died in the influenza epidemic of 2018 in the United States, you're right. A lot of them had underlying things like diabetes or non-communicable, cardiovascular disease or underlying respiratory disease. Mm-hmm. Maybe they were smokers, but there's still thousands of individuals who are perfectly healthy who died of influenza. That we know. So when you don't get your flu vaccine, you're taking a terrible chance. And why not? Well, I mean, what are you risking by getting the flu vaccine?
I'm busy, bro.
You know what? You know where I get my vaccinations?
Walgreens.
Even better. We have a big grocery store chain in Texas, a big supermarket called HEB.
You get it up the nose?
I get the injection, right? The pharmacist.
Really?
All of my vaccines I've gotten for the last few years have been given by the pharmacist.
Interesting. So
couldn't be easier.
Are you? Have you ever gotten the flu since you've been getting the vaccine every year?
I've gotten sick with a sore throat and feeling crummy. Was that a mild case of flu? I can't really tell.
Okay, but you've never gotten sick right after you got a vaccine. Some people do, right?
No.
Some people
no.
do get a vaccine and then they have an adverse reaction to it.
Well, sometimes, after getting your vaccine, you can get some soreness mm-hmm. and you can feel maybe a slight fever for a few hours or a day, but usually you're fine.
What is that?
What is that?
Yeah, what is that fever? Why are you getting a fever?
Because the vaccine is stimulating the immune system and stimulating the inflammatory system.
So even though you feel like you're getting sick because of the vaccine, it's actually good for your immune system.
That's right. And you're not really sick. I mean, it's nothing like as nearly as bad as getting the flu. Other vaccine, now that you're getting up there, you have to start considering is the shingles vaccine, Shingrix. Mm. And that's a great vaccine. It hurts, though, for a couple of days.
Do you take care of your immune system in other ways? Do you take probiotics? Are you cautious about your diet?
I'm not as cautious about my diet as I should be. I'm a junk foodaholic, actually.
Well, that seems like a terrible thing for your health.
It is a terrible thing for my health and something my wife is working on.
But that seems ridiculous for someone who works with health.
Yeah, yeah.
What's going on with you, man?
Sometimes, man, I just don't get it right.
How often?
What?
How often?
How often do I steal a bag of chips or something like that?
Garbage.
I don't know. No, hopefully not every day, but
not every day.
Yeah, maybe a couple of times a week. That's what with my Rachel, my daughter with autism. That's like our thing is to go to the it's called the burger joint or to Shake Shack to get mm-hmm. to get a cheeseburger. We'll sneak some fries. So,
so you
live in large, we call it.
Like that mouth pleasure so much, you're willing to sacrifice a little bit.
I have to concede that's the case.
Well, I don't have to tell you, but there's a large body of data that connects poor diet to a host of diseases. Mm-hmm. That seems like a crazy decision for a guy in your line of work.
There you go. Sometimes the it's not all brain. It's something else.
But, I mean, if you ate healthy food, I mean, the thing is your body starts craving healthy food. You start feeling
positive results. Yeah, no question about it.
Do you take vitamins?
I don't take vitamins.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't think they do. I don't think they're needed. Because most – in the American
– Hold up. You don't think they're needed while you're eating junk food?
Well, hopefully I'm not only eating junk food.
Yeah, but you know there's a large body of clinical research on the efficacy of vitamins, especially vitamins D, vitamins
B. I have taken vitamin D for periods on the recommendation of my internist. Yeah.
What about essential fatty acids, which are great for your brain, fish oil, all these different things that are fantastic for inflammation.
I'm not going to argue with you.
What is wrong with you, doctor? You got it over me.
Yeah.
Listen, but you would have a much better argument, don't you think?
You're making my wife stay here.
So. If you're taking care of yourself 100% instead of just concentrating.
But you still need your vaccines.
I'm sure you do, but vaccines aren't going to prevent cancer.
No, that's true.
Right.
That's
true. There's a lot of diseases.
Or diabetes or cardiovascular disease.
And a lot of these diseases are connected directly to diet.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Come on, man.
And other lifestyle changes.
Yeah, got to get exercising.
Sedentary life. I try to go on the treadmill for 30 minutes every morning. I do. Actually, I'm pretty good about that.
Yeah?
30 minutes every morning.
Why don't you just go for an actual walk? It's more interesting.
I do that too. So
I do
30 minutes on the treadmill in the morning, and then I take a long walk with my wife in the evening.
Oh, that's good.
But the thing that knocks the crap out of you is the travel.
Yes.
I find that very frustrating because you don't exercise right, and then you don't eat well, and you don't control the diet as well. So that's
I have a solution to that. And eat well and exercise. Those are solutions to that. Just do it. You know, I treat it like I'm brushing my teeth. I brush my teeth every day.
Yeah.
I exercise every day too.
Yeah.
So when I travel, I don't have an option. When I land, I go to the gym. This is how it goes. I land, I get in my hotel room, I put my shorts on.
Yeah, I do that too.
It's the only way.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you have to do it, if you say this is just what gets done,
right,
this is how you do it.
Yeah, I try to be really compulsive about that. So
yeah, I have it written out. I know what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. Especially if it's great if the hotel has a good gym, the hotel, you know, if they have weights and a bunch of different.
Or I'll run outside if we don't have it.
You run?
Yeah.
Do you?
Not very well, but
no. But you do. Okay.
Yeah.
We got to get you healthy, buddy.
Yeah.
Can't be pushing only chemicals in injectable forms to facilitate health.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair. Not chemicals. They're vaccines.
Oh, I'm sorry. What's in them?
What?
It's not, I mean, it's some sort of chemical, no?
No, they're antigens, right? They're
What's
they're
the fluid?
Macromolecules.
What's the liquid stuff?
Typically, it would be saline or, you know, salt water. And,
right. Now, what is missing from today's vaccine protocol, if anything?
In terms of diseases we should be vaccinating for, but
we're
not.
Is there anything?
Yeah, there certainly are. You know, one of them is a big problem among young infants, especially premature infants, called RSV, respiratory syncytial virus infection.
What does that come from?
It's a respiratory virus that peaks around the same time that flu does. So it's a very severe respiratory illness. So this is, again, one of those vaccines that's not a big money maker. So the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is trying to provide grants for supporting that one. That's a good one. And then there are all the diseases that affect poor people, both in developing countries and even among the poor in the United States.
Now, we're trying to make a this book.
That's the next one called Blue Marble Health.
The next one. So this is not released yet?
No, this is out. This actually preceded this one.
Now, this book is all about poor people and infectious diseases and the rise of these infectious diseases even in the United States.
That's right. So, you know, when we think about – led this big campaign to raise awareness of something called neglected tropical diseases, or NTDs. These are the most common afflictions of people living in poverty. I call them the most important disease you've never heard of. There are diseases like schistosomiasis and Chagas disease and leishmaniasis, and I've been devoting my life to seeing if we could develop vaccines for those diseases in the nonprofit sector, you know, because the big pharmaceutical companies just aren't going to take these on. So we're trying to do it in the nonprofit sector. But this book, the Blue Marble Health book, came out of some number crunching that I did using data from the World Health Organization or something called the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, which is based in Seattle, Washington, that found something very surprising. And that is most of the world's poverty-related diseases are not necessarily in the poorest, most devastated countries of Africa, meaning like Democratic Republic of Congo or Central African Republic. They're there, but on a numbers basis, most of these poverty-related diseases are actually in the G20 economies, the 20 wealthiest economies, together with Nigeria, which is not a G20 country, but it has an economy bigger than the bottom three or four. So that was pretty amazing for me to find that out because, you know, at first I didn't believe the numbers because I said, well, how could it be if they're poverty-related diseases? Why are they in the 20 wealthiest economies? And then I realized that it's among the poor living in wealthy countries. So the poorest of the rich today now account for most of the world's poverty-related diseases.
And what's the cause of this?
So why the link with poverty? Yes. So that's a great question. So one of the things I do in the book is I ask that, well, what is it about poverty that's making you susceptible? I don't think we really know. I mean, clearly in some cases, if you live in poor, dilapidated housing without window screens, things like mosquitoes and kissing bugs and sandflies can get inside the house. Or if you look in poor neighborhoods like in and around Houston, you see a lot of environmental degradation around the neighborhood. Mm. You see discarded tires that breed Aedes aegypti mosquito or standing water. But I don't think...
What did the tires do? Discarded tires?
So one of the best habitats for the mosquito that transmits dengue and Zika and chikungunya and yellow fever are discarded tires. That's what they love.
Whoa.
So this, you know, if you go into poor neighborhoods, you'll see a lot of tire dumping, for instance. And that's those are habitats for that Aedes aegypti mosquito, including here in Southern California.
So
is it
when the water gets in the tire?
That's right, a little bit of water. Puddle? That's exactly it, yeah.
I moved into a house once in Encino, down the street from here, in fact, and no one had lived in the house for about a year and a half, 2 years, and the pool had not been taken care of. And I went out into the pool, and it was green, and there were schools of mosquito larvae.
Mosquito heaven. Mosquito heaven, yeah.
So strange.
So you absolutely. You go into poor neighborhoods, abandoned swimming pools, things like that. That's where we're getting a number of these diseases.
Well, we don't have very many mosquitoes in Southern California. I mean, it's really kind of amazing in that regard.
Well, it depends. So, you know, in some counties where they do aggressive spraying and things like that, you won't. But in many counties, you probably in some of the poorer counties, poorer districts, you still do.
Well, I mean, in terms of the way it is on the East Coast. Mm. Like, I grew up in Boston, and in the summertime, you just have fucking mosquitoes everywhere. Yeah. They just can't get away from them. And then I've been to Alaska, which is the craziest place I've ever been to in my life in terms of mosquitoes.
Right.
Have you been?
I haven't been to Alaska.
But it's hilarious.
Yeah.
You get out of your car, and they attack you like a horde of birds.
That's because they only get 1 month of the year
exactly.
to do it. Exactly,
yeah.
To have fun,
so they're super aggressive, and they're also very large.
The big problem is along the Gulf Coast of the U.S. We have that Aedes aegypti mosquito, and that's why I got so worried about Zika virus hitting the Gulf Coast of the U.S.
Yeah. Mosquitoes in other countries, obviously, contain malaria. I mean, we've been very fortunate that that's never made it over to here.
Well, no, we used to have malaria. It used to be widespread in the United States. Both the one that was a real killer disease called falciparum malaria on the Gulf Coast, and even up into Illinois in the Ohio River Valley, we had a lot of malaria.
When was this?
Caused by vivax in the 1800s. In fact, there's a book written by Dickens when he visited the United States called Martin Chuzzlewit, and when he describes all these sickly people in Illinois, in Cairo, Illinois, on the confluence of the Mississippi and the Ohio River, he's clearly describing malaria.
Wow. Yeah. I did not know.
Yeah.
So what stopped it?
So that's a great question. So there's actually a very nice book written by a medical historian at Duke University named Margaret Humphreys called Malaria, Race, and Poverty. And she has a hypothesis, but I think she's onto something, that the malaria dropped in association with aggressive economic development. So that the FDR's New Deal included something called the Agricultural Adjustment Act that got people off of with agrarian pursuits and put them into factories. Quality of housing went up, and that's probably what caused a lot of the reduction in these tropical diseases. Remember, they're really diseases of poverty. Mm. In fact, I spent a lot of time working in China, and I'm seeing that play out right now in China. You know, China has had this very, very aggressive program of economic development, mostly in the eastern part of the country. But in the southwest part of the country, you go into Yunnan, Sichuan provinces, you go back in time 75 years and you still see those diseases that
so
are widespread.
Do you think that the best cure or the best way to stop malaria would be just to increase the economy of these areas in Africa where they're experiencing it?
Clearly, economic development is a very potent driver. Now, what it is about economic development, we still don't have our arms around that yet, but economic development is very important, just like for the neglected tropical diseases we study. But, you know, unfortunately for many countries, economic development is still decades away. So that's why – that's the rationale for developing these vaccines.
Is it because economic development moves people into more urban environments where there's less tropical diseases, period?
I think that's part of it, although now we're seeing some tropical diseases thrive in urbanized environments like, you know, yellow fever and Zika and dengue as well. So it's not only urbanization. It has to be urbanization with good planning that's not done unchecked, that outstrips the infrastructure in terms of water and sanitation.
So this brings me to the thing that I wanted to talk to you about in the first place, because this is what you brought up to me when we were doing this sci-fi show, and you said something to me that has been haunting me ever since, that the vast majority of people that live in tropical climates have parasites.
Mm-hmm.
Vast majority.
Yeah, that's right.
There's things like Toxoplasma gondii.
So let's look at the hit parade, right? The top one is one called Ascariasis, intestinal roundworm. The estimates are on 800 million people have Ascaris roundworms in their bellies.
Whoa.
So
800 million.
So more than 1 in 10 people on the planet, and mostly people who live in extreme poverty. 400 million have hookworm infection. 400 million have whipworms. A lot of these are wormy diseases. 200 million people with scabies, which is an ectoparasite on the skin that causes terrible itching and secondary bacterial infections. Schistosomiasis is another one. The point is almost every single person who is in extreme poverty has one of these what I call neglected tropical diseases. And one of the interesting features about them is they're very debilitating. They not only occur in the setting of poverty, but I think they reinforce poverty because they make people too sick to go to work.
Yes.
They shave IQ points off of kids when they have them.
Well, this is the hookworm connection to the idea of the slack-jawed, dumb Southerner,
in the United
States of America.
Right. And now one of the things that we have found, so Rahelio Mejia on my faculty, working with an environmental activist named Catherine Coleman Flowers in Alabama, found that hookworm is still present in Alabama.
Mm.
So among the poor.
Explain that to people so they understand what we're talking about, because for the longest time there was this stereotype about people that lived in the South that they were dull-minded.
Right.
And that this could be directly connected to hookworm infection, which had run rampant.
Right. There was even the term given called the germ of laziness, that hookworm infection, because it causes severe anemia. So if you're walking around with terrible anemia, of course you're not feeling up to working a full day and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
So hookworm was widely present in the southeastern United States at the turn of the 20th century. And then as malaria went down with economic development, so did hookworm infection as well. But we still have pockets in this country.
And this wasn't understood at the time, right? They didn't know that these people were infected with hookworm?
Forever, no, up until very recently. So the cause of hookworm wasn't discovered till 1900.
What is that cause?
It's called Nicator americanus, the American killer, and that's the name of the worm.
And this is from walking barefoot?
Or that goes in through the hands or enters all parts of the body.
But
so,
it's very common to get it from walking barefoot.
That's right.
Which was more common in the South.
Right, right.
Warm weather.
And so that's one of the diseases we've made a vaccine for that's now in clinical trials.
Mm. Yeah, when I found that one out, I was like, oh my God, well, that's it. That totally makes sense.
Right.
Because for the longest time, there was that stereotype. And then when you find out that it's directly connected to a massive infection of this disease, this worm.
So these are the diseases that are holding back people who live in poverty.
Yes.
And originally, I thought only in places like the poorest countries in sub-Saharan Africa or Southeast Asia. But now I realize it's these pockets of poverty across the entire planet that people are affected by these diseases.
And these diseases can be vaccinated.
That's we're trying to prove that we can make a vaccine against.
And there is a hookworm vaccine, right?
Right now in clinical trials, yeah.
Just in clinical
trials?
That's
right, that's right.
Now, wasn't there a Lyme disease vaccine, but the problem was it was actually causing people to get Lyme disease?
So that's a – to talk about controversial topics. So yes. So there was a Lyme disease vaccine that was developed actually from a colleague of mine at Yale University. And then it was – and they licensed it, I think it was to GlaxoSmithKline. And they developed it as – they called it Lymerix. It was the Lyme disease vaccine. And actually, most of the studies suggest that actually worked pretty well. The problem was there were a number of people who felt that the vaccine made them worse, or they said they had chronic Lyme disease, that it wasn't effective. So it was really a market perception problem more than anything else. And ultimately, it hurt the bottom line of the company, and they withdrew it from the market.
A good friend of mine's dad got the vaccine and then got Lyme disease. They think he got Lyme disease from the vaccine.
Probably not.
Probably is a weird word for someone with Lyme disease.
If that's being nice.
That got it from a vaccine.
No, he didn't get Lyme disease
from
a vaccine.
No way? Impossible?
Impossible, because Lyme disease is caused by the Lyme bacteria, the spirochete called Borrelia burgdorferi. Mm-hmm. And the vaccine is not a live vaccine. It's a recombinant protein-based vaccine, so it's not possible.
So there's nothing in that vaccine that could have caused this adverse reaction that they directly attribute to that vaccine?
Probably not.
You're saying probably.
Well, I don't know the patient. Right. I haven't examined the individual, so I hate to.
They swear. I mean, that's the narrative at that household.
Well, again, you know, it's reinforced by a lot of negative information out there on the internet.
Yeah, it's also reinforced by the fact they pulled the vaccine.
Yeah. Well, they pulled the vaccine not because it wasn't working, but because of market perception and all that sort of. And that was a time before the number of cases of Lyme disease have really taken off. So
that seems strange to me, because they didn't pull the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine because of perception. Why would they pull the Lyme disease vaccine because of perception?
I think the reason was is because the cost-benefit equation works a little differently. With measles is a killer disease. Mm-hmm. Lyme disease was not a killer disease.
But wrecking people now.
In some cases, it
seems to be connected to a host of other ailments too. Correct? Like Lyme disease, it just exacerbates a bunch of different, maybe possibly even existing health issues.
Well, you have to be careful. You know, and this gets into another controversial rabbit hole. I'm not sure we want to get into or not today, but the Infectious Disease Society of America, for instance, has come out with a strong statement saying that there's really no such thing as chronic Lyme disease, and the scientific evidence does not support something called chronic Lyme disease. Yet there are lots of people suffering with chronic debilitating illness who claim that it's caused by Lyme disease. So,
yes.
So this is something that is out there right now.
Why is there a debate? Like, why are they saying that there is no such thing as chronic Lyme disease? What's their evidence?
The evidence is that there's no evidence that they can detect spirochetes in the body. In many cases, people who have had Lyme disease don't have persistent evidence of having antibodies any longer to the Lyme spirochete. So it's a whole different area.
Right, but they do have this chronic inflammation and pain in their joints, body starts breaking down.
They have something, but it doesn't seem to be – the Infectious Disease Society of America, which is one of the lead infectious disease bodies in our country, and I'm not an expert on Lyme disease, so I'm not too comfortable going there with you, are saying that there's no evidence that that's actually associated with active infection with Lyme disease.
And how are they describing it, and how are they?
So in other words, what's causing all of these symptoms? Unknown.
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 Hmm. But isn't it bizarre that these same people got Lyme disease first and then had all these host of issues afterwards?
Well, I guess part of the problem is in some cases they had Lyme disease first, in some cases they really didn't have Lyme disease. Unfortunately, there are a number of unscrupulous healthcare providers, even physicians out there that are making the misdiagnosis. Either they're making a misdiagnosis of Lyme disease, or in some cases they're actually taking everyone who comes through the door and diagnosing them with Lyme disease.
Mm. I'm sure you're aware of the Lone Star tick,
right,
and the allergy to red meat.
Yeah, right. That's really fascinating, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, and that's another one that's on the rise, correct?
Yeah. Well, actually, all tick-borne diseases are on the rise now.
Yeah.
Possibly because of climate change, which is another factor in our country that's doing that. So we're seeing You know, if you look now at what are the big drivers of infectious diseases right now, in not only in the U.S. but globally, there are really some interesting forces, and a lot of them are social determinants. So a big one is poverty. That's a huge one. The other big one is political instability and war, because it interrupts public health control measures. So, for instance, Venezuela, which was leading public health control in Latin America for decades, you know, with the collapse of the economy in the Chavez era, now into the Maduro area, we've got a terrible situation where we've had measles return in a big way. So huge numbers of cases of measles. Well, we've had all the neglected tropical diseases come back, as well as malaria, Chagas disease, leishmaniasis. So it's really interesting how that is destabilizing the whole region, because now Venezuela has one of the largest diasporas of people, as big as the diaspora coming out of Syria and Iraq. So now the diseases are moving into adjacent areas of Brazil and Colombia and Ecuador. And so it's really – and that's another big driver is political instability. The third one we think is climate change may be very important. So, you know, why did we see this big – surge of chikungunya virus infection in the Western Hemisphere, or Zika. We don't really understand the forces of that. And what's going on in Southern Europe right now is quite concerning. We've had malaria return to Greece after it's been gone for 70 years. Malaria has returned to Italy. We're seeing schistosomiasis, a neglected tropical disease, on the island of Corsica. We've got dengue, chikungunya, West Nile virus across Italy, Spain, Portugal. So we're trying to understand why that is, and there's some thought that climate change may be a big driver of that.
Now, what other infectious diseases or parasites, rather, do they have vaccines for? Do they have a vaccine for toxo?
There's no vaccine for toxoplasmosis. There's a prototype malaria vaccine.
Prototype?
Yeah. Well, there's a malaria vaccine. It's called Mosquirix. That's the trade name. That was developed, supported with a lot of funding from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and working in partnership with GlaxoSmithKline. And that malaria vaccine now has been approved for use in children by the European Medicine Agency, and it's being introduced now in three countries in Africa: Malawi, Ghana, and I forget the third one. I think it was Tanzania.
Is there an adverse reaction that people have to that stuff? Because I know the traditional malaria medication, I had friends that took it and had horrible nightmares.
Oh, yeah. Malarium is terrible. Yeah. It gives you very lurid dreams. And No. And so far, no. I mean,
and so when you say children, how old are the children that they're vaccinating with this?
Well, the problem that you get into with malaria is that before 6 months of age, you have maternal antibodies on board. In other words, you're born with antibodies from your mother, and they'll start to wane by 6 months of age. So the ones who get hospitalized with measles, what's called cerebral malaria, which is a devastating condition, or severe malaria anemia, which is also a killer, are those children between 6 months of age and 5 years of age. So those are the ones that we want to protect.
Now,
and it's one of the leading killers of children globally, right?
Right.
Now. And we don't have a vaccine.
Sickle cell is connected to it, correct? Right? Sickle cell has something to do with people developing an immunity to malaria?
Yeah, I'm surprised you knew that.
I found out from Tiffany Haddish.
Who's Tiffany Haddish?
How dare you? She's a very funny comedian.
Okay. I'm sure she is, but she's right.
It's not really. Wow.
It's not really immunity, but it's a natural protection. So individuals who have the sickle cell trait seem to be partially resistant to malaria, and that's the thinking why the gene for sickle cell has been preserved in Africa for so long, is because it does confer some protection against malaria. So it's a reason for keeping the gene in the gene pool.
Yeah, we were actually discussing it because a friend that I grew up with died from it. So it seems to only exist in African Americans or Africans. Is that correct?
No, there's some other places as well, but predominantly in Africa and among African Americans.
So. Or people whose ancestors came from these tropical climates where they possibly
did. Yeah, so it's really quite an amazing story.
So there's no vaccine for toxoplasmosis. Is there anything on the horizon? Is there anything being worked on? Because that's a big one, right?
It's a real big problem among people with HIV/AIDS, for instance. Because it reactivates your toxoplasmosis, and we even see it in kids sometimes. But the thinking is
reactivates it. How so?
Well, what happens is it's in some countries up to 30% of people are actually infected with toxoplasma. And the parasite has the ability to undergo a dormancy state in the body until your immune system gets compromised, either because of AIDS or because if you get some kind of medicine that suppresses your immune system. And then it can reactivate it and cause what's called cerebral toxoplasmosis, which is quite serious. So most people handle their toxoplasmosis very well. You know, you die with it and don't even know you have it. But in some cases, it gets reactivated. Right now, there doesn't seem to be a lot of incentive for developing a toxoplasmosis vaccine, although I'd be very interested to work on something like
that. Why would there be no incentive? It's such a large-scale disease. It's hundreds of millions of people worldwide, right?
That's right. And part of the problem is we have almost no information on the actual number of people who have it and how extensive it is. So we call that disease burden. We don't have good disease burden estimates of toxoplasmosis.
I'm scared to get tested. I've had a bunch of cats. I've had feral cats.
Yeah, you're pretty.
And I'm crazy.
Well, there's a good chance you are infected, but as long as your immune system's intact, then you're okay. Now, there is a related disease that from cats called toxocariasis, and that's a parasitic worm infection we're finding in the United States among the poor. And that's a worm. So what happens is if you go into poor neighborhoods, you know, you see a lot of feral cats and dogs in poor neighborhoods, almost 100% of them have this worm in their intestines. And they're seeding the environment with eggs in their feces, and the feces are spread all over the poor neighborhoods. Kids come into contact with them, and the worm has the ability to migrate through the brain and cause cerebral toxocariasis. And I think it's an important cause of developmental delays. It's one of those neglected diseases in the U.S. I talk about in the book.
And there's no vaccine for that either?
There's no vaccine for it. And we have very little awareness about it.
Wow. Yeah, I've never even heard of it until just now.
Right.
So this
and it's not rare. I mean, in some cases, you know, up to 10% of certain populations like African Americans living in poverty are infected with it.
And it's primarily pets, or is it rodents as well?
Probably
or?
Mostly stray dogs. It's not even pets. It's mostly stray dogs and cats. And this is an example of a neglected tropical disease. Here's a disease of up to 10% of African Americans living in poverty in the United States, and almost nobody is studying it.
Wow.
Right?
And it can affect the way your mind functions.
Right. It's been linked now to developmental delays. So, you know, everybody wants to know why, you know, kids living in poverty have developmental delays, and people just assume it's because they live in deprived environments and that sort of thing. But I think toxocariasis is an important underlying reason for it. And this is an example of a neglected disease. You know, everybody's heard of Ebola, right? And everyone's worried about Ebola. And the truth is Ebola is never going to come to the United States.
Why is
that? It's never going to be because it's too difficult to transmit. Unless you have a complete collapse in the health system, we're never going to have Ebola epidemics in the United States. But here's a disease of 10% of African Americans living in poverty, and no one's heard of it, and there's no incentive to study it.
So that's why
I'm trying to raise awareness about these poverty-related diseases in the United States.
That's crazy. I mean, I don't understand why people don't talk about that one.
Yeah.
That one seems insane.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. It's a no-brainer, right?
But
it's very hard to get people to care about diseases of poverty. I mean, and this is one of the striking things about when I wrote the book was, you know, I've had a lot of success getting people to care about neglected tropical diseases in Africa and worked with, you know, the U.S. Agency for International Development to support a package of medicines that's now being administered to over 1 billion people annually. And that, you know, is one of my proudest accomplishments is helping to raise awareness about neglected tropical diseases like we've been talking about, hookworm and schistosomiasis in Africa, Asia, Latin America.
Right.
But the minute I talk about poverty-related diseases in the U.S., the lights go out.
Why is that?
I don't know. I can't figure out what I'm doing wrong. I've had so much success getting people to care about NTDs, neglected tropical diseases, in poor developing countries. But, you know, there's been no response to this book. I mean, it is And the estimates that I come up with in the book are we have 12 million Americans live in poverty with a neglected tropical disease. Toxocariasis is one of them. Another one is Chagas disease, and the list goes on. And it's been very hard to get people to care about the poor in this country.
That's very strange to me. Yeah. And I've always said that about the way we treat other countries. We want to send them aid and rebuild these countries, but we don't do anything about these terrible communities that have been terrible in this country for decade upon decade.
Right. And so I try to make the point the world has changed. You know, this old norm of global health, developed versus developing, it still exists, but it's going away. What we're seeing is a general rise in all economies. I mean, some African countries have 8 or 9% economic growth, but it's all leaving behind a bottom segment of society. And so I don't care where you show me poverty, whether it's in Texas or Alabama or Nigeria or Bangladesh, I will show you these poverty-related diseases. And, you know, I know what's her name? AOC, the congresswoman from New York, has talked a little bit about hookworm in Alabama. So last time I was in Washington, I dropped off a copy of the book in her office, but no response yet.
Well, she's probably pretty busy too.
Yeah, she's doing a lot of other stuff.
If you had a magic wand and someone said you could do whatever you want to fix this, what would you do?
So I did meet with a couple of people on the Hill, and they asked me that question, what's the magic wand? And there's a couple of things. One, we need to actually look for these diseases, because the problem is the diseases they cause are very subtle, like developmental delays. So that if you're a kid who lives in poverty with developmental delays, the pediatrician doesn't even think to do a test for toxocariasis. So we need to raise awareness. We need to go into poor communities across the country and actually take a blood test and actually measure for the presence of that disease or that parasite.
Once you find that disease, what would you do then?
Well, it depends on the disease. In some cases, we have treatments for it. Like the treatment for toxocariasis is a 5-day course of a simple pill of albendazole.
And it cures it?
And it cures it. So,
really?
Yeah. So we have interventions. So one, doing what I call active surveillance, looking for these diseases. The other one is really trying to understand how these diseases are transmitted. What is it about poor neighborhoods that is facilitating transmission? I think the third problem is the diagnostic tests themselves, because they're very complicated tests. Sometimes, they're done at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Our lab at our National School of Tropical Medicine does a few of them. But it's not like, when you go for blood work in your doctor and you get a little lab slip from Quest Diagnostics with the blood chemistries, the blood counts. There's no box there for toxocariasis and
right.
Chagas disease. So we need more improved tests, point-of-care diagnostic tests.
Not just also improved tests, but just letting people
make
it
more accessible.
Something.
Yeah, and so they don't have to send it off to the CDC or to, our National School of Tropical Medicine.
Is there a treatment for toxo?
There is a treatment for toxoplasmosis.
What is it?
It's a pyrimethamine sulfa drug, but it requires a long treatment course.
How long?
I'd have to look up the number of days. I haven't treated a patient with toxoplasmosis in a while.
And it kills it effectively?
It can, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was something you kept for life.
Well, if you don't get treated.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So
and then if you're immune compromised and it comes back, then that's a problem as well.
Mm. So most people that have it really don't even know they have
That's
it.
That's right.
Yeah.
And most people who have neglected tropical diseases don't know they have it either. In Texas, for instance, we have transmission of a parasitic disease called Chagas disease. It's a cause of heart disease. Members of our faculty were actually able to track down individuals who had donated blood, and the Gulf Coast Regional Blood Authority actually found people positive for Chagas disease. They were told to go see their primary health care provider. Unfortunately, the primary health care provider is not educated about these diseases, and they just assume it must be a false positive. So, our faculty had tracked them down and were able to get them into treatment.
And what is the treatment for Chagas disease?
It's an anti-parasitic agent called benznidazole.
And that kills it?
That can kill if you catch it early enough, but sometimes you don't catch it early
enough. So if it becomes systemic, then you have
– Then that's why we're trying to develop a therapeutic vaccine for this disease.
Oh.
But again, it's a therapeutic vaccine for a poverty-related disease, so it's very tough.
God. Man.
So the point is these diseases are widespread among the poor and we just don't pay attention to them.
Yeah. That's great. It's
and so I think, you know, again, I'd love to hear your thoughts. I mean, what is it that we just turn our backs on the poor in this country? It's
disturbing.
It's very disturbing.
There's a dismissive attitude.
And they disproportionately affect people of color as well, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, because it's so linked to poverty.
Well, also, right, slavery. Yeah. I mean, the history of slavery in this country. Then the history of systemic racism in places where they just literally would not sell homes to people who are African American. Mm-hmm. All these things are connected to the contribution of maintaining these impoverished communities. And there's been almost no effort whatsoever, other than the people living in the community trying to do better and raise everybody up.
Right.
There's been no effort whatsoever by the federal government to step in and try to rehabilitate, like a large-scale approach to rehabilitating places like the ghettos of Houston or Baltimore or Detroit.
You know, I thought I knew what poverty – living – I was – before I moved to Texas in 2011, I was chair of microbiology at George Washington University, and I thought I knew what poverty looked like. I moved down to the Gulf Coast. It's a different animal. I mean the depth and breadth of poverty – in the Gulf Coast and the southern part of the United States is just extraordinary. And it's been very hard to get people to want to really take it on and really address these poverty-related diseases.
Do you think – what do you think the cause of it is? I mean, you've studied this for quite a while.
What, the cause of the neglect?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. You know, is it something about American exceptionalism or something that we just don't want to admit? We have poor people. I don't know. You know, I wasn't the first to come up, you know, to raise this issue about poverty. When I was in high school or junior high school, I was forced to read a book. And at the time, I didn't care about it. It was called The Other America. It was written by a fantastic social activist named Michael Harrington. Who was I think someone told me he's a very devout Catholic actually. And so – and he wrote this book called The Other America. It talks about the hidden poverty off the road. And the actual number of people who live in extreme poverty hasn't changed since that book was written in the early 60s. That book was what helped Lyndon – first Kennedy, then Lyndon Johnson launch the war on poverty in 1964. I dusted off that book, and it still works today. And that's how I start out talking about my book, Blue Marble Health, about that book, The Other America by Michael Harrington.
Yeah, that is a very strange thing, our acceptance of these communities. And I mean, I've always said that if you want to make America a better place, the best thing to do is not invade other countries or intervene. The best thing to do is try to rebuild these impoverished communities.
Yeah, well, Gandhi
to give people a way out.
Gandhi once said a civilization is judged by the treatment of its minorities, and
yes.
We're not, you know, by that criteria, we're not doing so well. You know, our country was visited by the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Poverty in 2017, and his numbers came up with we have 19.4 million Americans who live in what's called extreme poverty, that is at half the U.S. poverty line. And roughly around 5 million Americans living on less than $2 a day, the same benchmark you'd use for global poverty everywhere.
5 million.
Yeah. And guess what? Those probably all have neglected tropical diseases.
5 million
people. Just like those living in extreme poverty in Africa and everywhere
5 million else. People living on $14 a week.
$2 a day, yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah. The wow. University of Michigan Center on Poverty has also shown that we have – I forget the number, 2.7 million families living on less than $2 a day, which is probably about the same as the 5 million number.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And again, this is not a topic that is very popular. I mean, when you see presidential debates, this is not something that comes
no,
up.
No, nobody talks about it. And again, even for disease. I mean, what are the diseases right. we hear about? Ebola and diseases like that. And sometimes in my frustration, I say, you know, these are imaginary diseases, and yet here we've got widespread diseases of the poor in the U.S., and the lights go out.
You remember when that woman came back from Africa, and she was a nurse, and she had been contacted with Ebola. She didn't have it, and they wanted to quarantine her.
Oh, yeah, and they stuck her out in some cabin on the airport or something
crazy
like
that.
It was terrible.
Yeah. What did you think about that?
I just thought it was so cruel. And
Is it just an ignorance of how it's transmitted?
That's right.
How is
that's
it transmitted?
Right. Well, actually, Ebola, you know, it turns out is the opposite of measles. Measles is one of the most contagious diseases known. It has a reproductive number of 12 to 18. What that means, if a single individual gets measles, 12 to 18 others get it, because the virus hangs around in the environment and it's so easily transmissible.
Hangs around like if you touch this table.
That's right. That's right. Or even in the atmosphere. Oh. So and that's why you get these really large measles outbreaks like you're seeing in Washington State. And usually those are infants under the age of 12 months, not yet old enough to get vaccinated. They're the ones who wind up hospitalized and sick. The Ebola is just the opposite. Ebola is a reproductive number of 2 or 3. So unless you're taking care of a dead or dying Ebola patient or someone who's recently died, because it's only towards the end stage of the disease that you really get large numbers of virus particles in the body, you're not going to get Ebola. So the reason it's being so hard right now to contain in Democratic Republic of Congo is not because it's so highly contagious. It's just that the place is decimated by the collapse in infrastructure associated with civil war. So even though we have now an Ebola vaccine, it's hard to vaccinate everybody.
And how is it transmitted?
Ebola by contact with fluids of somebody with Ebola.
So it has to get into your tissue somehow or another?
Right, right.
Yeah. Oh, what else should we worry about? You're freaking me out.
Well, the point is a lot of these diseases are solvable if we just put our mind to it.
So one of the things people are even aware of it.
Things I say in the book is because these diseases are so widespread among the poor in the G20 countries, if we could get the elected or the leaders of those G20 countries together at a G20 summit and say we're really going to do something about the neglected diseases in our own borders, and I'll include the United States, we could get rid of 2/3 of the world's poverty-related neglected diseases right off the bat.
Wow.
So a lot of it is political will, or ignorance or lack of awareness and political will.
Well, it seems like in this country, ignorance is a big part of it, because this is something I've thought about many times, but I didn't know about Chaga. I didn't know about a lot of these other diseases you're describing.
Yeah, no. I mean, so we need to raise awareness about these. That's why I'm so thrilled to come here, because I've just amplified the number of people who've heard of this concept of blue marble health, which is a name that I've given, a different name from global health to separate it from the two. So, you know, coming on here is so powerful in terms of amplifying that message.
So, again, back to the magic wand. What could be done? I mean, is it a funding issue, or is it at first, before that, an education issue?
Well, I think there's multiple issues. So, I mean, the drivers we've been talking today about promoting these diseases, really tough to do anything about extreme poverty, war and conflict, climate change, clearly there are some things we can do, aggressive, unchecked urbanization. But the other things that you can do is build better tools. By that I mean better diagnostics, better drugs, better vaccines. And unfortunately for these poverty-related diseases, there's no market incentive for it. So it falls to academics, to professors, to people trying to do this in the nonprofit sector. And we're doing the best we can, but it's not nearly as good as having access to getting the pharmaceutical companies involved as well.
It also seems like this would cost an insane amount of money to just go through all these poor communities, test everyone, and start distributing these drugs. And what would pay for all that stuff?
Well, you know, some people have asked me, well, what would the Affordable Care Act take care of this? And I said, well, we're two steps away from the affordable. We're two degrees of separation away from the Affordable Care Act, because we're not even recognizing these diseases.
Yeah, you got to know about it first.
Right.
I mean, what percentage of the population even knows about all these parasite created diseases,
or know that vaccines don't cause autism?
Yeah, well, that one is that's the biggest one, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough one.
And again, I don't understand it. I mean, I'm just saying it. I'm saying vaccines don't cause autism because you're saying it,
right?
You know, and I think this is part of the boat. Is a lot of part of the problem. We're in this boat with a bunch of people who are scientifically illiterate, like myself, who are discussing these issues, who don't really know what they're talking about. Like I saw someone talking about tetanus because some boy had tetanus, mm-hmm. and he was in the hospital for a long time, and his hospital bill was like $1 million.
Oh God, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, because it's an ICU admission, right?
Right. Yeah. And they were saying, hey, you know, why didn't this kid get a tetanus shot? And it goes back to the same thing, right? That people don't want these vaccines.
And yeah.
That could have prevented.
And again, I don't blame the parents. I think the parents in some ways are victims themselves, are victims of this very aggressive misinformation right. campaign that's out there.
Tetanus is a big one though, isn't it?
Yeah, tetanus, and we have a vaccine for it. That's part yeah. of the what's called the DPT. That's one of the first vaccines mm-hmm. you get as an infant. There's no excuse for having a tetanus case in the United States.
Right, and this kid was unvaccinated, right?
Right. Yeah. That's my understanding.
Yeah. I mean, is there a cure for tetanus outside of vaccines?
Well, I mean, there are supportive measures that you can do, but, you know, they require hospitalization, ventilation, putting on a respirator. Mm. And you could still die. So it's an awful, awful disease. I've seen tetanus working in Central America and elsewhere. You see a case of tetanus, you never forget it.
What is tetanus technically?
Well, the other name is lockjaw, where your muscles go into spasm and including the muscles involved in breathing, so you can't even breathe as a result of it. It freezes the muscles.
What is doing it?
What's doing it?
Is it a parasite?
It's actually caused by a bacteria. The bacteria releases a toxin called tetanus toxin.
Oh, that sounds like a horrible way to go.
It's terrible. I mean, these are awful diseases. And I think one of the things that the anti-vaccine group or lobby, as I call it, does is they try to be very dismissive of mm-hmm. these diseases. They try to deliberately downplay the effects. I mean, you'll see this stuff on the web, measles, build your immune system.
I have seen that.
You said it yourself. So
well,
you
I
said
to
you saw
it
that
up
somewhere.
To you. I didn't read it.
Yeah.
I just saw it. And
yeah,
I said, that doesn't make any sense. Let me ask.
It's crap, right?
Yeah.
What
are they saying? What is the?
They're saying it's just a rash. It builds your immune system. It makes you stronger. It's something out of from a different planet. I don't know where they're coming.
But we
from.
Do. I think the reason for that. Becoming popular is because we do kind of helicopter parent our kids a little bit too much. They should come in contact with a bunch of different things because it does build their immune system, correct?
Well, that's an interesting hypothesis called the hygiene hypothesis
right.
that says, you know, if your kids are living in too sterile environment, then this can also result in autoimmune diseases mm-hmm. and things like that. But
allergies.
And I have mixed feelings about the hypothesis. To me, it's not airtight by any means.
Not airtight, but there's some sort of a correlation, particularly between peanut allergies and keeping peanuts away from children. And that there was a study shown, there was Jonathan Haidt's work mm-hmm. In one of his books, talked about how there was a study done in communities where they didn't protect kids from peanut allergies and the much smaller percentage of people developing peanut allergies mm-hmm. versus kids that they did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this is also one of the things that the anti-vaccine lobby is doing now that they're, you know, and when I write a book like this, Vaccines Don't Cause Autism, now what you're seeing, remember I told you about that whack-a-mole business where mm-hmm. they went from MMR to thimerosal to spacing vaccines too close together to aluminum. Mm-hmm. Now there's some groups that are moving away from autism altogether, and now they're saying, well, vaccines cause autoimmune disease or vaccines cause other neurologic deficits. But it's all flim-flam.
It's all flim-flam. There are vaccine courts though, right? And vaccine
there
courts,
are vaccine courts, yeah.
And they have handed out payments to people who were injured by vaccines,
right?
What is that?
So you know, it was, for instance, if you look over a 10-year period, I think it is between, I haven't looked at the numbers in a while. I think it's between 2008 and 2014, 2015. Over that period of time, there were 2.5 billion doses of vaccine given, 2.5 billion, of which the vaccine courts identified around 200 that were a list of serious injuries that they have a table of that they could attribute to vaccines. So there were 2,000 payouts, and of those 2,000, 80%, they didn't really think were attributed to vaccines, but they paid it out anyway because that's how the courts work, and then 200 where they could really say, yeah, it looks like this could be related to vaccines. So you divide 200 by 2.5 billion, that's 1 in 10 million.
Or even 2,000 by 2.5 billion. It's still not a million cases.
That's one in a million.
And these cases, what was happening to these people other than the shoulder injury that you were talking about?
Yeah, there's a list, and I talk about it in the book. There's actually a table you can download on the web of, for each vaccine, a list of potential injuries that they allow.
And these potential injuries, is it, as we were talking about earlier, is this just biological variability that some people just react differently to different things?
I think in some cases we don't know. In other cases, you know, with the live virus vaccines, if you have a severe genetic and immune deficiency and maybe it wasn't picked up, then there's that risk. Mm. But, you know, what's a one in a million, what's a one in a 10 million risk? As I said, we have to keep that in perspective because the odds of getting hit by lightning is one in 700,000, if you believe that number. Or, you know, what's the risk every time you take your child out in a car and drive around the neighborhood? I'm sure the risk is far higher than one in a million.
And the real danger is these actual infectious diseases spreading and the damage they could do, tetanus.
They're coming back, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, measles is an awful disease, causes measles encephalitis, measles pneumonia.
I find that a lot of people that are steadfast in their resistance to vaccines, they also believe in a lot of other questionable things.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like these things get lumped into these groups of things that they don't trust the government about.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that's probably true.
Yeah. That's what sucks about having a sketchy government.
It was interesting. So, you know, I said, you know, we need to hear from the Centers for Disease Control more and the Surgeon General. Now they're starting to speak out. But, you know, the people counter that say, well, part of the problem is people don't trust their government. And I say, well, that's true of some. But I think most people, if we had a, you know, more visible public health force out there, people would listen to it.
Well, I think that what you're talking about in terms of these poor neighborhoods and these parasites getting into people's system and affecting cognitive development. Mm-hmm. And what was the other one besides Chaga? What was the
toxocariasis was the one that affects cognitive development.
And the fact that there's actual cures for these things, too. I mean, that
I estimated in a paper there are 2.8 million African Americans living in poverty with toxocariasis.
Wow.
This is not a rare disease, Joe. This is a common disease.
But it's so unknown.
But it's occurring among the poor, and it's a chronic and debilitating infection. It's not dramatic. It's not Ebola. It's not killing people.
Is this mostly in warmer climates as well?
It's more common in the South than in the North.
Is it because they have longer time to stay alive?
Because the eggs are in the environment, and the worm develops within the egg.
Is there any other diseases that are going on that we don't know about?
Most
people aren't aware about?
Yeah, sure. There's a brain parasitic infection called cysticercosis.
What's that one from?
That one is from eggs, often from individuals who have a tapeworm.
Oh.
So we're seeing cases of that. There's some of the viruses transmitted by mosquitoes. One of the ones we don't talk about a lot, which is a very serious infection, is West Nile virus infection.
Mm.
That's got very high rates of not only encephalitis, but also one of our faculty members, Christy Murray, is showing very high rates of depression and other neurologic debilitation for. And that's another one we could probably use a vaccine for, but there isn't the market incentive to do it.
West Nile virus does come up, though. At least that's discussed in the news and people are aware of it.
Right.
You knew it as soon as you said it.
Right.
But there's no vaccine.
There's no vaccine. But there could be.
What is it? There could be. What's holding it back?
What's holding it back is lack of market forces, lack of financial incentive for the pharmaceutical companies to take it on.
There's an extremely large investment to develop something along those lines?
That's right.
What it is?
Yeah. I mean, vaccines are, from an investor's perspective, a tough sell because, you know, there's a possibility. You know, first of all, you need many years of clinical trials. It can sometimes take two decades from the original conception of a vaccine to actually going through a clinical trial. So the hookworm vaccine I've been working on, we've been doing it since the 1990s. So we're talking decades-long time horizons. When you talk to an investor about something with decades-long time horizons, you figure it out, right? The lights go out. I mean, very, very quickly.
Where it gets gross, right? Because this is all – we're relying on these private businesses to invest money to cure a public health issue.
That's right. That's right.
That seems kind of crazy.
Well, so in response to that, what happened was after the Ebola fiasco in 2014, where we didn't have an Ebola vaccine in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, a group of individuals came together at Davos, the World Economic Forum, and including the Gates Foundation, and they developed this concept, or which an organization called CEPI, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovation, to incentivize biotechs and pharmaceutical companies to embark on diseases for which of pandemic potential, like Ebola, like Lassa fever, like MERS coronavirus infection. And that was great, but the problem was they didn't address these poverty-related diseases. So those of us who are working on poverty-related diseases are still kind of on the outside looking in.
It just seems like having everything managed by private companies that need to – they need to have some sort of a financial incentive to attack these diseases. That seems like a crazy way to deal – with health crises.
That's right. That's right. And so what I've recommended is, I said, that organization, CEPI, is great for what it's doing, but we need another mechanism. What I've proposed is that since these diseases are so common among the poor in the G20 countries, these are the 20 largest economies, to put together public sector funds for that purpose.
Public sector funds for investing in developing vaccines and treatments?
For poverty-related diseases, these chronic debilitating diseases. And in fact, you know, we can show that working with health economists, we actually work with a terrific health economist whose name is Bruce Lee of all names. He's a professor at Johns Hopkins.
Seems like you would change your name.
Yeah, right. he loves it. And he's been able to show that our vaccines are not only cost effective, they're cost savings, meaning that they're economically dominant, that they'll actually save money. The problem is doesn't help you with the fact that you still need some. But the return is on public health. You still need somebody to come along and provide that investment. So what's happened is our technical ability to develop vaccines has outstripped our financial instruments that we have to do it. So I get a stream of young people in my office wanting to go into global health. I mean, the commitment for this next generation. I know they get a lot of bad press, but my impression is this next generation, their commitment to public service is at an all-time high. And they say, you know, Dr. Hotez, I'm all in. I'm going to go into global health. And they're a little bit disappointed when I tell them, get an MBA or get a law degree, because where we need the innovation now is in the finance sector. There must be a business model out there that would work, that would figure out how to do this. I just don't have the background to do it.
It seems like once the momentum is in the corner of this being handled by the private sector, and that the private sector has to develop these vaccines and these treatments, and they have to do it with some sort of a financial incentive. If they don't have a bucket of gold at the end of the rainbow, they're not going to take a ride.
That's right. That's right. So
fuck, that's crazy.
It's crazy, but that's the reality. And so what the exciting thing about what I do is, you know, developing these vaccines for poverty-related diseases, is there's no roadmap. Right now that we're in clinical trials, I don't know what the roadmap is to get to licensure and getting these vaccines out to the public. The terrifying thing, the thing that keeps me up at night, is there's no roadmap.
Right. So it's both good and bad.
It's both good, yeah.
There's how much does it cost to get a vaccine, I mean, in general, from developmental period to actual application?
Well, the pharmaceutical companies have traditionally said billions, but I don't think that's the case. I think one of the reasons they're doing that is because they're also recovering their R&D costs. You know, they're putting money into R&D that they charge in order to, you know, either make a profit or at least stay even. So, for instance, the cervical cancer vaccine, the HPV vaccine, that, you know, when I last looked, was $420 for the three doses. It doesn't cost $420 to make that vaccine. It's just that they're recovering their R&D costs, which is fair enough. So one of the things that we're proposing to do for our neglected disease vaccines is we'll de-link the R&D costs. In other words, if we've gotten grants, whether it's from the Gates Foundation in the past or the NIH or the European Union or the Dutch government or the Carlos Slim Foundation, we're not going to pass those costs on We'll just, you know, that was used for R&D, and we would just cost for the cost of goods. So at least we can get it down to just a couple of dollars a dose, a few dollars a dose.
Now, for anybody that's listening to this conversation and they have additional questions, where's the best place that you should guide them? Would it be your books?
Probably the books, because I wrote the books for lay audiences. My lay audience is sort of, I mean, somebody with a college, university education. But, I mean, they're not, you know, it's – They're published by Johns Hopkins University Press, so and they are kind of – they're uneven in terms of how weighty they get into the science. But certainly the vaccines did not cause Rachel's autism. I wrote it with the idea of parents, vaccine-hesitant parents, and also the pediatricians, because the other problem with pediatricians is, you know, they're there in their office and parents are – reading this stuff on the internet, and they come in loaded for bear into the pediatrician's office with all these factoids, and the pediatrician's like, well, gee, I never heard that before, and then the pediatrician is made to feel stupid, like he's not keeping up with the science. He is, or she is, but it's just they're not keeping up with the misinformation. So I provide talking points in the epilogue of the book.
And Blue Marble Health is the best resource for people to understand these.
About diseases of the poor in wealthy countries. Then I have a third book that I wrote a few years ago called Forgotten People, Forgotten Diseases, that describes the neglected tropical diseases.
Well, I really hope that what comes out of this is someone gets motivated to create some sort of a documentary really on both subjects. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that we would greatly benefit from some clarity for people that do have concern about autism that's in a digestible form, for good or for bad, people like to watch documentaries.
Right. I hope you don't get too beat up over this because I know the anti-vaccine groups are very passionate.
I don't have a position. I don't know why they would beat me up.
Well, they beat me up a lot.
I'm sure they'd go after you, and they already call me a shill. They call me a shill for a lot of things, though, believing in the round earth. Jamie has a T-shirt that he sells at youngjamie.com. It's round earth shill.
Right.
Literally. I've been called a round earth shill.
Round earth
shill. People believe the earth is flat.
Right.
There's a lot of those. Yeah. I don't know if you know.
I didn't know that.
There's a lot. So you get beat up no matter what if you're talking. But I really think it would do a good service if somebody did put together a documentary, because I don't think most people are aware. I think most people are just relying on this fear, like that vaccines do cause autism. There's also this connection between people that are older, correct? When they're older and they have children, there seems to be a more likely.
There seems to be, and that may be related to as you get older, your sperm or your egg have some genetic instability and more likely to produce mutations.
Yes.
That's probably the mechanism. That would go hand in hand with the genetic basis of autism.
And then the Blue Marble Health book, I mean, what you've been saying today about these diseases and how many of them exist and how many of them are almost unknown, untreated, undiagnosed, and just how many people are unaware. I really hope that someone does something about that too. Well, but in the meantime, people can buy your books. Are they available in audio as well?
Definitely the vaccines did not cause Rachel's autism is audiobooks, and I'm not sure about Blue Marble Health.
Okay.
But you can get it on Amazon.
Well, thanks for being here. I appreciate it. It's good to see you again.
Well, thank you for raising awareness of all this stuff. I really appreciate
it,
Joe.
My pleasure. And I appreciate you coming down here and explaining a lot of this stuff for us.
It's been a great time. I really enjoyed the opportunity.
If people want to get a hold of you on Twitter, what is your Twitter handle?
Just @PeterHotez.
Okay. Thanks, sir. Appreciate it.
Thank you.